Coming up, got Tom Haverstraw breaking down game four of the Thunder and Pacers, an epic comeback by the Oklahoma City Thunder. I tie it up 2-2. Then later, we get into some draft talk with some trade ideas for the Sixers, the Jazz, the Spurs, bunch of other teams. And of course, we also hit the Kevin Durant rumors, what could go down there, our favorite fits, and a lot else. That's coming up right now with Tom. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We just watched Oklahoma City storm back in the fourth quarter, win in Indiana against the Pacers, 111-104. Incredible defense down the stretch. To discuss it all, Tom Haverstraw, what's up?
What's going on, Kev?
Tom, I'll tell you what, man. Indiana's offense this entire postseason, pretty much, this entire series against OKC has looked like itself. And in some of the comebacks they've had against Milwaukee, against Cleveland, against OKC, against New York, against everybody, they look like themselves to close games. The final 3 minutes of this game, they only had 1 point. And it felt to me, for the first time, a lot of hero ball. You had Nembhard dribbling the clock out multiple times, Halliburton airballing a three on a switch against Chet Holmgren. Chet was incredible. OKC was switching everything. OKC turned it up, man. They turned it up defensively and won that game in the fourth quarter, man, and especially in the final 3 minutes, I felt like, is my number one takeaway of this one.
Yeah, this is all postseason long. This is when the Indiana Pacers are so comfortable. Like when the game is close, final 2 minutes of the game, this season, Tyrese Halliburton entering tonight's game was a preposterous 13 of 15 shooting from the floor when the final 2 minutes of the game with a shot to tie or go ahead. 13 of 15. And none of that was apparent in this one because he didn't get the ball all that often. Kev, I don't know about you. I just kind of felt like you said, Nembhard was going a lot of ISO hero ball there. And I wanted to see the ball in Halley's hands a lot more than what we saw. And on the other end, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, just incredibly clutch, incredibly confident with the ball. And he did get away with that travel on that baseline jumper to go ahead with about 2:30 in the game. But I loved his aggressiveness. And I think that like 48-second little rest that Mark Dagnall gave him in the fourth quarter, where I was looking on the floor, like, where is SGA? He's off the floor just getting a little bit of rest. And as soon as he came back in, man, he was pedal to the metal and he won that game for them.
Yeah, SGA was incredible, 35 points, and to close the game well in the fourth quarter. It felt like, you know, I say incredible because of the way he closed, right? But for the most part throughout the game, I felt like SGA wasn't fully what you'd expect. Seemed a little bit fatigued at times. He was getting points, but it didn't feel like he was imposing his will on the game until, as you said, after that break where he's, you know, a lot of high post, a lot of stuff at the elbow, going to work, baseline as well. It looked like, you know, type of vintage scorer, right? It's like taking pages out of Kobe's book, somebody from the 90s or the 2000s is what it reminded me of. It was cool to watch him do that. But, I mean, ultimately, though, I want to talk about defense too, because OKC clamped down, man. Indiana, they had no oxygen, man. They had no oxygen down the stretch of the game, and I think that's important because of what we've seen them do in this entire postseason. Even when they're down, it's like, how are they going to do it this time? But 2:35 left in the game, Nembhard misses a shot, a zero pass possession. 2:04 left in the game, had a turnover on a botched handoff to Halliburton. 1:43 left, Halliburton airballs a three on a switch against Chet Holmgren on a two-pass possession. 1:08, another two-pass possession. Nembhard misses a pull-up against Chet Holmgren. He got the ball with 16 seconds left, didn't give it up until 5 seconds remaining when he shot it. And then with 27.67 seconds left, switched everything again on OKC. Chet clamped them up. Indiana, man, I feel like this was the opportunity to win it all here. Yeah. I felt like before this game, Tom, this game was going to decide the series. If OKC won this and tied it up 2-2, I'd pick them to win the series. If Indiana goes up 3-1, I'm not picking OKC to win three in a row. I felt like the Pacers missed their opportunity right here, and somehow it came down to this 3-minute stretch to close the game. They were in it, man. They were in it.
This is where they wanted to be, right? This is where Indiana feels most comfortable on their home floor. It's a close game. They've won so many of these, 9-1 in this postseason in clutch games, and with Halliburton just going nuclear on every single opponent, and they could not pull it out. And a lot of great defense by OKC. I think primarily, I just love Alex Caruso on the floor for them in these big moments. He hasn't been starting these games. They go with that lineup change to start Isaiah Hartenstein going back into the starting lineup for Kayson Wallace. And I think Alex Caruso, he needs to be in that 30-plus minute range and closing out defensively. A lot of good stops by him. But Indiana, they were playing Indiana Rick Carlisle basketball for about 45 minutes of this game. And then they got completely out of that. And some of that credit goes to Oklahoma City defense, the best defense by a mile in the regular season, one of the best defenses in NBA history. By my eyes, I thought for most of this season, this was the best defense I've ever seen. And they showed it down the stretch, putting the clamps on Andrew Nembhard and the rest of the Indiana Pacers that were moving the ball relentlessly for most of this game. And then they turned into the worst version of themselves and gave it away. I have a lot of family and friends in Indiana, and they were texting me before this game, Kev. They hadn't been this nervous for an NBA game in a very long time because they knew what was at stake. They could have gone up 3-1 in the NBA Finals, and now they got to go back to OKC 2-2, and it seems like all the momentum just shifted from Indiana with this Cinderella story, and now it's back to that 68-win team, OKC, that looked like they were just going to go roughshod over the rest of the league.
You mentioned Alex Caruso, Tom. 20 points for him off of the bench. He had like a nasty fadeaway in the second half, a self-created shot. I mean, like OKC can't hit anything. They're 3 of 17 from three in the game. 3 of 17, 17.6% from three in the game. Once again, they struggle to shoot. You need guys like Caruso to come out and score 20 for you. He did it with 7 of 9 from the floor. Obviously, what he does is primarily on the defensive end of the floor, and he was sensational again, as you said, with 5 steals. But SGA doing what he had to do. Jalen Williams had a good game, but you need those sparks. And here was Alex Caruso. Yeah. I couldn't believe the pull-up fadeaway that he had. That was nuts.
It was crazy. And you look at the way that OKC was so bogged down offensively. They needed every single one of those 20 points. You look at the numbers. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander finished with 0 assists in this game, Kev. The last time we have seen Shai Gilgeous-Alexander have 0 assists the in an bubble. NBA game was the bubble. Yeah, you saw
last
that
game
too.
Of the regular season.
And he got hurt like halfway through the game, so it wasn't like a real game. But if you look even further, the last time a finals player had 35 points and 0 assists, at least 35 points and 0 assists, it's the logo back in 1962.
No way.
That's how rare what we just saw from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And Tom, there are plays that, It's been 60 years since we have seen a 35-plus scoring performance in the NBA Finals with 0 assists. Now, there were a couple where he should have gotten an assist, but it was just a weird play, didn't finish it. But that is such a strange outing for a high-volume scorer, a guy who plays at the guard position, to have 0 assists. And it speaks to how hard the Pacers were making these shots for all of the OKC shooters. It wasn't just that they had, a handful of three-pointers in this game. It was that the volume, they weren't getting open shots. And how rare is it do you see a team shooting 17 three-point attempts in today's NBA game? The fewest three-point attempts taken by any postseason team this year. And I felt it the whole entire game. They just were not letting Jalen Williams and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander drive to the cup and kick out to shooters. It was basically forcing them to hit low percentage shots in the mid-range all game long. Until the end, they started getting downhill. And Kev, you saw those kickouts and the offense looked a lot smoother. And I just thought after what we saw in game 3, Kev, this OKC team looks like the fiery, much more just more athletic down the stretch. I thought that this team, OKC, looked out of gas in game 3, but it was the opposite in game 4.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely there, Tom. And, you know, I'll tell you what, I think they felt out of gas early, but like every time they would punch, it felt like Indiana had an iron chin. Like Indiana would just take it and then punch right back. Like when Toppin had the 2 threes in a row after a 6-0 run by the Thunder in the middle of the third quarter. Like it happened time and time again throughout the game where the Pacers just took it. Until the end, where the Thunder showed their conditioning and showed their grit and showed their toughness and showed their ability to be resilient, as we've seen from them in the postseason. They did it against Denver. They had a great comeback against the Nuggets in the second round. They've had their comebacks as well. And ultimately, man, I thought like the difference, I mean, I mentioned earlier, OKC's defense against Indiana in the final 3 minutes, switching everything, Chet Holmgren on an island. He's really struggling offensively, but he was awesome defensively down the stretch. The shot-making aspect of Nembhard versus Halliburton juxtaposed against SGA and Jalen Williams and what those guys did down the stretch, as you said, with their creation. It just felt like that the edge was in favor of the Thunder there down the stretch of that game. And with SGA, man, biggest quarter of his life. That was the biggest quarter of his life. You enter the fourth quarter trailing, and you outscore the Pacers 31-17 in the fourth quarter with you as the driving force of a lot of that. And Jalen Williams was as well. But I thought SGA hit some unbelievable shots. I know he had the little, you know, off arm push on Nembhard on one of them on the fadeaway and the baseline, but like that's Michael Jordan did it. You know what I mean? Like that's the finals, man. That's the way it is. It's the way it's always been. It's the way it always should be. I thought he was absolutely sensational down the stretch of that game. Obviously, he's incredible.
Yeah, Kev, what did you make of Isaiah Hartenstein starting, going back into the starting lineup? Very interesting that they actually made that switch to start game one in the first place, and then Dagnall goes back to the original starting lineup that carried them throughout the season. And I wanted your take on it, because that I had a feeling. I figured there might be a lineup change going into game four. I don't know how it impacted tonight in your eyes. What were your thoughts?
You know, I think Dagnall's throwing some darts. Maybe he shouldn't be. It's the NBA Finals. Maybe he should be sticking to one rotation and that's it. But I feel like with putting Kayson Wallace in the starting lineup to begin the series, putting Isaiah Hartenstein back out there to begin this game, it feels to me like Dagnall is still figuring out the best rotations, the best lineups for this Pacers team. And Hartenstein was fine. You know, I don't think he had a great game by any means, but he was very solid. Ultimately, I'm a little bit surprised that you're not seeing Caruso for 35 minutes. I mean, we saw him for 30 tonight, a high in the series. I'm a little surprised you don't see even more Caruso. Maybe this is time for OKC to tighten their rotations even a little bit more moving forward in the series. Because it feels like, you know, Aaron Wiggins, he had a really good game earlier in the series. He was really rough tonight. He took some hero ball shots, I thought. Kayson Wallace made some really bonehead decisions out there as well. So, you know, maybe this is time for Dagnall to tighten things up. What do you think about it, Tom? What were your thoughts on that rotation?
I thought it was all about Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Yeah, I thought it was about Shai. It was all about getting him free. Yeah, exactly. Is having so much energy built into trying to break free from Nembhard and Nesmith, that I think a lot of that switch was to free him up on those screens, get some daylight, get some oxygen, allow him to get some space to attack at the rim. And also, I'll just point this out, this Oklahoma City team has been terrible at second chance opportunities in this series. A lot of that is because one of their best guys on the boards, on the offensive boards, Isaiah Hartenstein, has been out of the rotation for the most part. And in this series, heading into this game, Kev, they were shooting 31% effective field goal percentage, according to Inpredictable.com, 31%. Off of second chance opportunities. So once they get an offensive rebound, they were basically taking contested mid-range jumpers or the equivalent of that every time down the floor. I think they were trying to get not only a good screener out there for Shai, trying to get him free, but also try to play big. You know, it's not like Indiana is this massive twin tower team. And I think you saw it tonight. You know, Chet Holmgren, he gutted that out down the stretch, and he has been really tough, really struggling in fourth quarters in this series, scoring just 2 points in the fourth quarter. And I think a lot of that energy you saw down the stretch, we might give credit to Dagnall pushing that button to get Chet Holmgren some help in the first quarter and not have to do all of the rim protection and rebounding for this team. I think it was a good move that does. If you look at the box score, Isaiah Hartenstein, 2 points, 6 rebounds, 2 assists in 21 minutes. But I think Chet Holmgren, the way he played defensively down the stretch, I think you can owe a lot to that, to some fresh legs, because he looks injured out there, but he made some big gutsy plays.
I think that's spot on, Tom. I think the way Chet ended that game, the way he was moving on the perimeter in those moments, it's as if OKC knew we're going to switch late. We're going to switch everything. And they decided to attack Chet. It was him on an island against Nembhard. He locked him up. It was him against Halliburton. He forces an air ball. It was him against Halliburton. He contains him, forces a kick out to Miles Turner. Time and time again in the final 3 minutes, it was Holmgren on an island, and he stepped up huge. And I think you're right. It's because he had fresh legs despite, you know, 2 ankle turns in the game. He was fresh mentally and physically to close that game out at a really, really high level. And you got to give Chet credit, man. A lot of guys, I know it's the NBA Finals, but he continues to defend at a high level despite things really not working for him offensively. He has not produced well offensively at all. I know he had 14 points in this game, but it came on only 4 of 9. I think at times he's just looked overwhelmed physically. He has not shot the ball well from three at all this series. He's only made 1 3-pointer. He's missed 12 in the series. Taken 12 in the series, made only 1 of them. Pretty horrible, obviously. But ultimately, he's still defending. And in this game, he ripped down 15 rebounds as well. You got to give the dude credit for putting it out there on that end of the floor.
Yeah, I thought he looked like overmatched for most of this game. You know, a lot of those drives at the rim, he just... Mm-hmm. And the screening, you know what's so interesting is when you got a guy who looks that weak laying out for a screen, if you're going to get pushed back, you know, you're not going to set a hard screen, but also you might be considered an offensive foul a lot of times when you're just kind of like not able to hold your position strong. And I think he's guilty of that a lot of times. Is if he's just not stronger there, that frame, it's going to get a lot of offensive foul calls on those screens. And man, I didn't want to say this too early into the show because it's not the number one most important thing, but there were so many ticky-tack loose ball fouls in this game. It was a Scott Foster game. If I asked you, Kev, who was the crew chief in the last game, would you be able to answer that question?
It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter because it shouldn't matter. It should make no difference, but you know the extender was out there tonight.
It was every rebounding, every screen, every loose ball foul. It was a foul call. It was insane. I have to get the numbers up. I don't have it in front of me, but I felt like that was like a record loose ball foul, non-shooting foul game. So many stoppages in this. And I do think it impacts the game. When we saw how gassed OKC was 2 nights ago, and then you see all the stoppages, you're going to benefit if you have tired legs. And I think it was a case where way too many whistles, way too many stoppages, and those replay reviews. Kev, we need to put a shot clock on replay reviews. It shouldn't take 4 minutes for us to decide whether that was a flagrant or whether that was a technical or what have you. If you can't figure it out with 1 minute or 30 seconds, then what are we doing out here? Like, what are we doing? If you can't figure it out, just go with whatever the original call was, or just come up with the decision. We do not need to be standing there watching these referees stand around with their headsets any longer than we did tonight.
Yeah, I will say I think the officiating favored OKC in this one. The non-call on Caruso swiping his arm across Halliburton in the first half. The flagrant on top, and I thought it just looked like a hard playoff foul. The out-of-bounds on Caruso on a layup in the second quarter. Neesmith, a blocking foul on the Jalen Williams drive. A Siakam foul on Caruso off-ball in the third quarter. I thought it was, you know, as Richard Jefferson called it, a hand-to-hand combat off-ball. And the foul that put Chet at the line with 10 minutes left on the fourth. I don't think he was in a shooting motion. A lot favored OKC in the game. A lot did. Now, of course, OKC fans can say the same things about some of the calls that went in against Indiana or for Indiana as well. But I felt like it was pretty heavily leaning towards OKC in this game. Would you agree there, Tom? Or am I being a bit unfair to the Thunder here?
I don't want to say the game was extended by Scott Foss or the series was extended by Scott Foss. I'm not going to go that far.
The extender.
There have been studies on this that show that there isn't really much evidence to suggest that he is the extender. And I think as of like a week ago, it's still on his Wikipedia page.
It's an awesome nickname. It really is.
How does the NBA allow that? Like, you think someone at the league office would be like, we need to delete this from the Wikipedia page for Scott Foss that he's known as the extender, but it is an incredible nickname. I think this was a case where OKC did get a benefit of some extra calls there. I think that they ended up winning this game on its merits, and I just feel bad for Indiana because, man, they had this yeah. game. I felt like they blew a huge opportunity to go up 3-1 in this series. And man, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, that's why he's the MVP. He took over late with those drives. He had this nice little dump pass to Isaiah Hartenstein with a few minutes left. And I think it was Nembhard who knocked the ball out of his hands, and then Hartenstein laid it up. That would have been his first assist. I couldn't believe it when it happened. I was like, I don't think he's had an assist. Almost had it there, but it was because he got downhill, and so much of that shell, so much of that defense from Indiana is just making sure they do not get him into the paint, and he's going to take a contested 12-footer. That's okay. They'll live with that as long as he's not getting all the way to the rack, and they did such a good job for about 40 minutes tonight, but that's what it takes. You got to go all 48 minutes against this team.
Hey, thank you everybody for participating in the live chat on YouTube, X, Facebook, and TikTok. Give us a like, a thumbs up if you've not done so already. It really does help us out as you're watching us live tonight. Appreciate you watching us. Tom, I want to talk about Jalen Williams with you for a minute here because we've talked about a lot in this game. I think we glossed over Jalen Williams a little bit because his role was so important. SGA throughout the entire game getting pressured 94 feet again. They're just shading him off ball constantly. Somebody's always on his ass. And Jalen Williams in this game, 27 points, 7 rebounds, only 3 assists, had some really sloppy turnovers as well. He had a Siakam, I think, stole it from him 3 times in the game, poked it loose from him twice in the first half, I remember for sure. And then he opened the second half with a turnover as well. And then he got blocked on a step back 3, he had an 8-second violation. He had some down moments. And yet I come away from this game feeling like he gave everything that he had to put OKC in a position to win the game down the stretch. Like, where are you at with Jalen Williams in this game in particular? And what could it mean for the remainder of the series for the Thunder?
Just getting to the cup, man. I love his scoop layups, dude. Like, I think that's one of the most unheralded skills in the NBA is your ability to pass with one hand and make a layup with one hand. Get quick to the basket. He's so good at that. You know, like, when you talk about skills that players need to have coming into the league now, watch what Jokic does with one hand and the way he can control an entire defense by holding the ball with one hand and being able to fling passes everywhere. It's one of my favorite skills in the league. Jalen Williams is so good at those like little scoop layups where he kind of has you on his back and he's just going to lean forward and get it off the rim. This guy is so talented. 27 points and a performance in the finals that a year ago, we weren't so sure that he was close to this. Like, Jalen Williams being a go-to scorer down the stretch for OKC in the NBA finals, I think we were thinking that was maybe 2-3 years away for J-Dub to do this at this level. But he was very good at getting to the rack, going out in transition, and they needed that because so much of what Indiana wants to do is force you in those middies. He didn't have his middy going tonight, but he was going at the rim, and that's what you want to see.
Yeah, I mean, he was great. He got to the rim, as you said, had 11 free throws in the game, made them all, hit some big shots in the fourth quarter. I mean, it was SGA in the end, but leading up to that, and I think he had a huge layup, driving layup with around 5 minutes left, had an assist to SGA where he attacked the closeout, kicked it out to him for a 3 as well. He made the plays, and he's also great defensively as well. Like, he does other stuff on the floor besides just score the ball. Anything else from this game, Tom? We miss anything from Thunder Pacers that comes to your mind?
Yeah, I mean, we got to just say it. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander averaging 32.8 points per game in the NBA Finals. He's averaging 33 points a game in the Finals. So, like,
pretty good.
This is all time.
Pretty good.
This is pretty good by Mr. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. I think he's one of the great scorers we've seen in the NBA. And I'm not talking this year. I'm not talking the last 5 years. I think all time. When you're talking about his ability to score at every level, he showed it tonight. He's just an incredible scorer that, yes, for most of this game, he didn't get to the free throw line and he did get to the charity stripe late. But the dude is, I mean, he's the MVP for a reason. 33 points per game in the NBA Finals, his debut in the Finals. Luka Doncic was around there last year for Dallas, but they didn't get to two wins. And I think this, if he does this, it's going to be one of the all-time great scoring performances in the NBA Finals if they win this, when he's scoring at this level. So Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, even though he had no assists for the first time in 60-plus years, Kev, he was awesome. He was awesome when they needed him. Mm-hmm.
Still can't believe OKC won a game with hitting only 3 of 17 three-pointers. Bam! I wouldn't be able to sleep crazy after this one if I were a Pacers fan, Tom. Do you feel like OKC won themselves the series tonight by tying this up?
Yeah, I do. I do. They're going back home for the last three games of this series. They're going to have two of them on their home floor. I mean, it was such an opportunity. They couldn't hit a shot. God. They weren't getting to the free throw line. And the assists, like the ball wasn't moving. And on the other side, Indiana was playing the Pacers basketball, the brand of basketball that has gotten to this point, and then it all fell apart.
They were flying. The Pacers were flying. Early in the game, the Pacers looked more crisp than they have all series, I thought, which was saying something considering the way they play. And OKC just looked lost when SGA wasn't initiating the offense at one point, man. I can't believe it. I really can't believe it.
Yeah. Also, Pascal Siakam, he had 20 points, 8 rebounds, 5 assists, 5 steals. Only 3 other players have done that in the NBA Finals. Their names: Jimmy Butler, Scottie Pippen, and Hondo, John Havlicek.
Wow.
So that's, and they lost. So that's a game just filling up the box score, and he was awesome. But it's just, that's a tough L for the Indiana Pacers. And they'll get one more, at least. They'll get one more. They're going to have at least, that game 6 is going to be in Indiana. But that one, they gave it away. They gave away game 4 for sure.
All right, Tom, let's talk about some non-final stuff because we got a lot going on around the NBA. Let's start off talking about Kevin Durant. We got news this week. Earlier in the week, John Gambadoro out of Phoenix reported that the teams have been condensed. The front runners for Kevin Durant: Houston, Miami, Minnesota. Shams came out on Friday verifying that information, that the Rockets, Heat, and Timberwolves are the front runners for Kevin Durant. And Shams added that a trade could actually happen this weekend. I've heard personally from sources I've talked to that the Suns are being really, really, really aggressive trying to get this done. They want to get it done sooner than later. It's my understanding the Suns want some clarity of what their draft night is going to look like. They want as much time as possible to get players in for workouts, depending on where picks are. They want to get this done sooner than later. That's what the Suns want to do here, and maybe we will see something this weekend. Maybe we'll have an emergency podcast over the course of the weekend. But Tom, of those three teams here, Houston, Miami, Minnesota, what do you expect here? Is there a team that you're feeling has an advantage here with the offer they could put on the table? What's your sense of this situation for Kevin Durant?
Yeah, Houston makes the most sense to me because of the pick situation, is that Phoenix can get back some of their draft intel or draft pick artillery that they've lost in those trades. But people need to remember here, with the Minnesota Timberwolves as a factor here in these trade talks with Kevin Durant, why would Phoenix ever want Rudy Gobert in a trade Kevin Durant?
I don't think Gobert would be involved. I don't think it would be Gobert.
I'm just saying, though, they don't really own their picks going forward, so why would they want to bottom out? They can't bottom out with Devin Booker, so they're going to want to upgrade at the center position. You can do that with Isaiah Stewart. You can do that with Rudy Gobert, but the salary matching, I don't know how you make a deal with Minnesota. Is it Julius Randle coming the other way? Are you going to really trade Kevin Durant?
Maybe Nas Reed.
I mean,
Rob Dillingham and the deal. But here's the thing. Like, here's the tough part with the timing. If it's Minnesota, Minnesota before July 1st is a second apron team. So they can't aggregate salaries until July 1st. So like, if you're talking Minnesota, it's incredibly difficult to put a deal together, which is why with the Suns rushing things here, I don't think it's Minnesota. Unless it's like you agree in advance and then you wait until July to make the deal, when Minnesota will not be a second apron team and they therefore will be able to aggregate salaries, sign and trade Naz Reid, et cetera, et cetera. So like, there's a lot of, you know, moving parts here, but I don't think it's the Wolves if it happens before July 1st. I'd be surprised if it's a if it's the Wolves. I'd be surprised if it's the Heat. Like, why? Why Miami? And with Houston, I get Houston makes a lot of sense. Like you said, Tom, they have the picks. They can give up Phoenix their picks back. But I still can't help but think it's somebody we're not talking about. That it's not one of these front runners. That it's a team that's going to come out of nowhere and say, we want KD for 1 year, just like Kawhi to Toronto, just like Paul George to Oklahoma City. Maybe you win a title like Kawhi in Toronto and then he leaves. Maybe you make a run like he did with Paul George and he decides to resign because he likes it there. I just think it's going to be somebody who comes out of nowhere. That's my gut feeling, that it's going to be somebody we're not expecting.
It's not going to be the Knicks. I don't think it's going to be the Knicks.
No, it's not going to be the Knicks.
I would say they don't even have a head coach. You're going to trade Kat straight up for Kevin Durant, you got to figure out who your head coach is. You got to settle all that before that happens.
Might have been Ian Begley. I forget who exactly. Somebody said that the Knicks aren't going for KD. Based out of New York, they said Knicks are not a suitor for Kevin Durant.
What about San Antonio? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, they need shooting bad. Gambo is ahead of everything this year with the Suns. He's always ahead with the Suns. And Gambo said today on his radio show that he doesn't think the Spurs would get Durant unless they gave up Castle or number two. Now, it's very possible that he's getting fed information from the Phoenix Suns that inflate the value of Kevin Durant, or it's possible that a team out there is putting out a stronger offer than you might expect for a 37-year-old player with only 1 year remaining on his contract. It's like, let's just say it is Minnesota. Rob Dillingham was drafted 8th a year ago. He was drafted 8th. So if you're putting Rob Dillingham on the table in a Kevin Durant deal, that's a guy who was a top 10 pick 1 year ago, who a lot of teams value still as that level of prospect. So if Gambo is right in saying that about the Spurs with an offer for KD, I think it at least suggests that there's something out there, a quality young piece, somebody that has value as a young player going to Phoenix in return for Kevin Durant. Who exactly? I don't know. I'm just using Dillingham as an example here, but it's noteworthy because Gambo's been on top of it with this KD stuff. He's been on top of it. So just throwing that out there to you, Tom, to kind of get your feedback on how far, because I wouldn't go that far if I'm the Spurs. That's for damn sure.
I wouldn't. No, for sure. I was just going to say, if it is going to take the number two or Castle, I say, thank you very much. We'll see you on the floor. I don't think it's going to be San Antonio if that's what it's going to be. Right. But to me, it sounds like Michigan State. I literally just said Michigan State. Suns. It seems like Phoenix. I can't believe I just did that. Maybe I should believe that I just did
it
that.
It is totally understandable. It's completely understandable. I bet Ishbia himself even does that.
Yeah, it's just like, let's go Spartans. Suns. Sorry.
Phoenix Spartans.
I think the Heat and Minnesota stuff, it might seem like posturing or leverage play to me. It feels a little bit like that because I think it's going to be Houston, given the Ime Udoka and Kevin Durant situation, given the fact that they had a serious need.
Can you explain for that, Tom? The Ime and KD situation? Can you get into that?
Ime was in Brooklyn while KD was over there, and it seems like they had a relationship, or at least a positive one, that could be, if you're going to acquire Kevin Durant at this stage of his career, I think you would want to have that type of relationship with the head coach, or trust with the head coach, because you've got 1, 2 maybe great years left of Kevin Durant. And if you're going to win a title, I think you need all the alignment there with the head coach, your star player, and Kevin Durant. So I think also the fit. you know, not only do they have the draft picks to flaunt over there to Phoenix, they also have Reed Sheppard, Jalen Green, and maybe what, like, I wouldn't put too much of that, but they have so many good young players. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't put Amen Thompson into a deal, obviously. But no. I think they have enough assets here that could be attractive to Phoenix. And I think the need in terms of making that leap next year and trying to take that leap from a scoring standpoint, I think Houston makes the most sense here. And throwing the Heat into that mix and Minnesota, I think it's a way to try to get more asset, draw more assets out of Houston for a 37-year-old star.
Tom, I think with Houston, you could be on to something there, because think about what I just said about the Spurs. If Gambo's right about Castle or number two need to be in there for them to make the best offer, Houston could be, I mean, Jalen Green's still young. He's still a young guy. Jabari Smith is a young player. Reed Sheppard drafted number three just 1 year ago. If those are the types of assets Houston would be putting out there, considering their surplus of picks and young players, they can afford to give something like that up and still have a lot of young talent on their team. Like, if they give up one of those pieces for 37-year-old Kevin Durant, you still have a really young team. Plus Kevin Durant, right? Like, it's just the way it is with Houston. So I think Houston makes the most sense for a lot of reasons. And also the front office change with the Suns as well. I reported earlier this year, which was the true at the time, that the Suns didn't want their own picks back. That very well may have changed with a new front office here, moving from James Jones to one of Ishbia's best friends from Michigan State.
Brian Gregory hires. Oh, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. The guy, the one coach that went to Michigan State, we hired him, just happens to be the guy. I don't want to take away from Jordan Knott, but it's just, no, you could see that coming from a mile away.
Of course.
Hey, I got to say, Reed Sheppard, just real quick, coming off the bench, like another guy, Devin Booker from Kentucky. I love the fit there. I don't love the fit, Jalen Green next to Devin Booker, but Reed Sheppard would certainly get all of that sunlight to become the player that you and I both think he is. I think he's a stud. And if Phoenix gives him the ball and says, you and Devin Booker just go cook like you did at Kentucky, I think they would be really fun to watch.
A couple related newsy things. I've heard that after the Suns deal Kevin Durant, their next move is to trade Grayson Allen or Royce O'Neal, that they're shopping trades around with those guys, and that's the move that comes after Kevin Durant. I've heard the Brooklyn Nets and the Pelicans in the NBA draft. The Nets obviously could be connected to a deal in a three-way absorbing salary as well, involving KD stuff, but I've heard they really like Jeremiah Fears in the NBA draft. They have the eighth pick. Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff going on around the draft right now. A lot of misdirection, a lot of smoke screens, but that seems like pretty solid at this point, that they like years of eight, and they definitely need a point guard. One thing that we know is that Russell Westbrook declined his player option, and now he's going to be an unrestricted free agent heading into the 2025 summer. Do you have a favorite fit for Russ, Tom? Is there a team out there for Russ that makes sense anymore?
If he couldn't make it right with Denver, I think he's going to come back with Denver. I think this is just giving him some options just to see where things land this summer. But I don't see Russell Westbrook leaving a situation where he can ride the coattails of Nikola Jokic, a team that I think given the new / old head coach in Adelman, you would suspect that Russell Westbrook would want to come back and play with Jokic, who made things so much easier for him. I can't see a situation where Russell Westbrook is going to be a plus contributor for a playoff team or a contending team at this point. So I suspect that Russell Westbrook will go back to Denver. At this point, Russell Westbrook, if it's not coming back home to OKC, I don't think that would be a reunion that they would want to have right now at this stage. But hell, you know, Russell Westbrook at this no. Please, no. I don't think we need that. I think KD, if I said this on the Big Number this week, if the Pacers just won the last three games of the series and won the series in five, I think the Oklahoma City Thunder would have to look really hard in the mirror about their roster construction and how they're going about their business. getting an upgrade at the veteran position and trying to get some more experience in there and maybe bringing back KD, I don't think it would be too crazy if they got
I had the same thought tonight, Tom. I had the same thought. I was like, well, if they lose the series in five, go get Kevin Durant.
I mean, because that offense looks terrible for most of this game. Terrible, right? To get a guy who can get you a bucket on command. And they pulled it out. So, yeah, maybe Kevin Durant not going to OKC this summer.
The Knicks are going to meet with ex-Grizzlies head coach Taylor Jenkins and ex-Kings and Cavs head coach Mike Brown. I've heard Mike Brown is the favorite for the Knicks for their head coaching position. What are your thoughts on that, Tom?
Yeah. So no Steve Kerr, no Eric Spoelstra. We haven't heard any of those rumors that they're checking in with those respective teams. No.
Not yet.
So they decided, all right, we'll try for these unemployed coaches in Taylor Jenkins and Mike Brown. Look, Mike Brown is a great defensive mind. He's since his Cleveland days has always been known as a great defensive coach. They're going to need to improve defensively, but I also think they need help on both ends of the floor. Taylor Jenkins is really interesting. I think he had a really strange season with the new coaching staff and kind of the mutiny that happened there in Memphis. And he doesn't have the postseason experience that I would want if I'm the Knicks. Like, you have a guy in Tom Thibodeau that took you to the Eastern Conference Finals, and you're going to bring in a guy with no experience of getting that far in the postseason. I would suspect that Mike Brown, of those two candidates, would be more likely to get that job, considering he's had a lot more experience on a championship winning team in the Golden State, as well as getting to the finals with the Cavs in 2007.
I'd be very interested to see what type of offense Mike Brown wants to install there. Like you said, we know he's a defensive guy, but we saw what he did with the Kings offense when he changed the system there when he was first hired. Obviously, things kind of fell apart for the Kings after that unbelievable, you know, light the beam first season. But he did show off, you know, some offensive prowess. And so I wonder if he could install some motion, some movement, multi-ball handler, multi-creator stuff for the Knicks that has otherwise been really lacking for that team. And so we'll see over the coming week as they interview people and as they bring in potential head coaches, what they decide doing. Well, deeper conversation about the Knicks later. Some draft news that did come out this week, a rumor, not really news as much. Michael Scotto said the Sixers and Spurs have had talks, or at least the Sixers have called the Spurs regarding the number two pick in the draft. And Philly's the spot, man, really, where things get super, super interesting here, because Ace Bailey is pretty close to the consensus number three prospect in this draft class. Not everybody has him third, but most do. But for Philadelphia, they're in a position right now where you get Joel Embiid, you get Tyrese Maxey, you got Paul George, you get Jared McCain, you get a lot of veterans in that rotation. Ace Bailey is so raw and has so many holes currently in his game and a style of play that is more on a, I want to be a star trajectory more so than I'm cool with being a role player, like Kuminga-esque in that sense, like he was for the, or is for the Warriors. And so you have the Sixers in this position trying to trade up, open to trading down. I look forward to seeing what they do here, but ultimately I'd be surprised if they were to move up to two. Do you see any reason for the Spurs to look into moving down to number three? What would it take for you to actually do it if you're the Spurs to go from two to three?
Yeah, for me, I think Philly, the guy that makes the most sense is VJ Edgecombe. I love that guy. I think he is a stud. I think he is going to be a future all-star in the NBA. Defensive-minded, an incredible athlete who gets after it defensively. I think he would fit exactly in this NBA Finals in 5 years. Like, his brand of basketball, he is a tough-minded guy. 2.3 steals every 36 minutes. One of the highest rates of anyone in the first round. I think, and projecting NBA players going forward, steal rate. Your ability to get steals at the college level is like the strongest indicator for whatever reason, whether it's instincts, basketball instincts, your desire, all of the, your motor, your length, your speed, all of that at the college level. Statistically speaking, it is a huge harbinger of NBA success. And he has, if not the best steal rate in the class, right up there. And so when you watch that guy on film, he doesn't have the greatest shot. He's not the greatest in shot creation. But the Philadelphia 76ers don't need that. They got Tyrese Maxey. They got Paul George and Joel Embiid. You know what they need? Is a high flyer, an athlete, a grinder defensively. And I think that Edgecombe fits that dynamic, fills that need way more than, say, Ace Bailey. I would hate Ace Bailey in Philadelphia. That makes no sense to me. So if anyone's going to trade out of that position at two or three, maybe the Philadelphia 76ers trade down if someone really wants kind of this home run swing of Ace Bailey, thinking that he's the next Tracy McGrady. I think he's probably more like, Brandon Ingram at his best, or someone who's Andrew Wiggins at his best, but not the defensive side. I don't love Ace Bailey. I don't love his shot creation. I think he is so in love with the mid-range shot and his ability to kind of hit that and rise above. He's really long, but I just don't see him as a long-term winning player. I love Edgecombe. I think he's the guy at three. And San Antonio is interesting. Like, is Castle and Harper and De'Aaron Fox
Before we go to the Spurs, I want to talk about the Sixers there, Tom, because with Edgecombe, yeah, I think you're spot on. I think you're right about him as the fit for Philly, whether it's three or whether it's a trade down, because of everything you said. But also, he still has upside. Like, you're not just drafting a role player with Edgecombe. He showed he could be a role player for Baylor this year. 3-and-D guy, you know, grinding on defense, hitting threes, you know, making the right play and all that. But he's watching his guards just dribble the air out of the ball all year long. And you didn't get to see him handle the ball or run point like he did when he was playing for the Bahamas national team next to DeAndre Ayton and Eric Gordon and Buddy Hield. And you watch those games, and that's where you see VJ Edgecombe as a guy in a context where he is more of a lead facilitator rather than just a bystander. And you see his ability to get to the basket, to get into the mid-range, to make the right pass. And so for Philadelphia, you want to check both boxes. You want a guy who can help you in the short term and hopefully optimize your chances of making a run if Embiid is healthy in mid-April and beyond. That's what you need in the short term, but you also need some upside for the long term. And that's where VJ Edgecombe makes a lot of sense, because he is an elite athlete. He's a high flyer. He's shown flashes of being able to generate shots himself, but he can also settle in and be a role player. At more youth levels, he was more of a grinder on defense before his offense began to emerge. And so with Edgecombe, I think he checks both boxes short term and long-term for Philly, whereas Ace Bailey is more just checking that long-term box and not helping you in the immediate when it comes to winning games with Joel Embiid, Tyrese Maxey, and this core that you have today. Now, flipping this to San Antonio, moving up for two, same thing. Dylan Harper helps you in the short term and the long term. That's why Philadelphia would want him. You put him into space with Joel Embiid, with Tyrese Maxey, and all these guys, it would make sense. He can play defense. He can play a smaller role. He can help run the show. He can get into the paint, yada, 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 yada. Until they move up to number two, it's not worth spending a lot of time about Dylan Harper in Philly, because right now it's more likely about the Spurs. I wrote about that this week on Yahoo. I wrote a thing about how is Dylan Harper, Stephon Castle, De'Aaron Fox really the best way to build around Victor Wembanyama? Do you think it is, Tom, or do you think the Spurs should be looking in a different direction?
Yeah, I don't see. I want more playmaking. I want more guys that can have the vision. And Chris Paul was their best passer last season. I don't think De'Aaron Fox is a natural.
You want
playmaker.
More like true points for the Spurs. That's what you're looking for the Spurs. Interesting. So you and I look at their situation a little differently. You want more true point. I want multi-ball handler, which is what I think they're going for if they do get Harper, Castle, Fox. But I just don't think it's enough shooting. That's my concern with it. So I think you and I both don't love the fit, but for different reasons. Yeah.
I don't love the fit. And honestly, I would be surprised if they hold on to this pick and draft Dylan Harper. And you know, I'm a huge legacy guy. I love second generation players. And Dylan Harper, his father, Ron Harper, they always seem to exceed expectations at the next level. So I think in terms of the fit in San Antonio, I don't love it. And who knows what Shallon, Victor Wembanyama is going to be up to this upcoming season, especially coming off the DVT. We don't really know exactly what kind of condition he's going to be in. But like, do you envision Wemby as being like a point center? And like, you don't need a facilitator or a pass first guy. You would rather have just a knockdown shooter at the point guard position is what you're saying, right?
No, I just want multiple points of attack. I want all five guys on the floor to be able to create a shot, make a play, shoot the ball, like kind of like what we see with Indiana. OKC doesn't move as much as Indiana, obviously, with cuts and off-ball motion and speed and all that. But Caruso can attack a closeout and make a play. Cason Wallace can attack a closeout, make a play, hit a shot at the end of the clock. Like all their guys can. Lou Dort was more of a point guard at USC in college. So like all of these guys can do a lot of that stuff off the dribble. That's what I want for the Spurs, but you need shooting to do that. You need shooting. And so Castle, he's an iffy shooter. He's always been an iffy shooter, always been sub 30%, always hovered around 70% from the free throw line. Fox has become a higher volume three-point shooter in his 8 years in the NBA, but he's not improved his efficiency off the catch or off the dribble. And then Dylan Harper, this week I watched all 104 of his misses at Rutgers from three-point range. 24 of those misses either hit the backboard, airballed, or got blocked. 22% of his misses missed towards the left side of the rim. 19% of them missed towards the right side of the rim. So he's not a guy just missing short or long on his jumpers. He's spraying it around everywhere. He's got a flat release, which is why he gets blocked sometimes on a shot despite his size. If you want to look, you know, at genetics, his father was not a great shooter, 72% in his career from the free throw line, below 30% from three. His brother, Ron Harper Jr., was a poor shooter as a freshman at Rutgers, became a good shooter as a senior, has been a closer to average three-point shooter in his G League career, for what it's worth. But with Dylan Harper specifically, he has not shown great three-point shooting prowess or pull-up mid-range shooting prowess or free-throw shooting ability in high school or college. And so with him, I want to see him in a situation with space. I want to see Dylan Harper in a situation where the ball is in his hands and he's empowered to get into the teeth of the defense, get into the paint and finish. And the Spurs are one of the bottom 10 three-point shooting teams in the entire NBA. And I don't think it's a great fit for Dylan Harper. And I don't think Dylan Harper is a great fit for the Spurs, but he is the second best player in the draft class, because if the shot develops, the dude has everything else pretty much. He's an elite downhill attacker, a very good playmaker, a relentless worker, a high character kid. In theory, his defense should become highly versatile as he develops in the NBA when he's, you know, playing with other guys, handling the ball, and he doesn't have the whole load on him offensively. In theory, he could become the best player in the draft class if he develops into a knockdown shooter. But that's a huge leap considering where he's been throughout his life so far.
I'm going to throw out something for you. What if
Throw it out.
What if Utah moves up and wants Dylan Harper to be their point guard or swing guard of their future, and the Lauri Markkanen fit in San Antonio? What if they move down?
Wow.
And Markkanen goes next to Wemby? I think Utah is going to want more in that deal if they're giving up Markkanen, but they're going to want to move up. They don't have a point guard of the future.
Isaiah Collins. If I'm the Spurs, I say, no, want number two? You want number two? You just give us Lowry with five. That's it. We're not giving you anything else except Keldon Johnson, Harrison Barnes. Enjoy.
What if you get Knipple with the number five pick and you get the shooting? You got Markkanen and Knipple at five. Think about that. If you want shooting?
God. I would love Knipple on the Spurs, man. I would love Knipple with Victor Wembanyama, because that's the thing. With Victor, you asked me earlier, do you envision him as like a point center, right? No, I envision him as one of five, a guy who's running dribble handoffs, playing in motion, playing fast, rolling hard to the rim when a defense is stretched out from a shooter receiving the ball out of a handoff or a screen, and Victor's got an easy lob at the rim, or he's on the short roll and he's kicking it out to a knockdown shooter in the corner. That's what I envision for Victor Wembanyama. Not three guards who are at their best offensively with the ball in their hands, Harper, Fox, Castle. Castle can do a lot of different things for you offensively, but he's more like in that like Iguodala type of role where he's a cutter, but he's not a knockdown shooter, but he's still very good as a downhill attacker, getting into the paint, running pick and roll as well. Fox, like we know who he is at this point of his career, and Harper is also at his best with the ball in his hands. I want Wemby on the floor with guys who are elite with the ball not in their hands and very good with the ball in their hands. Because Victor's going to be a guy who's a hub, man. Like, he's going to be run. He should be running DHOs. He should be initiating some offense, but not as the only guy, not like a heliocentric style. That's the way I envision it, Tom.
Yeah. I think the more I think about it, I want this deal to happen. So you think the five and Markkanen for the number two pick, with, of course, some salary filler coming from San Antonio in that deal. Utah not getting the number one overall pick, not getting Cooper Flagg, and then not having a chance at the number two prospect who happens to be at a position of need. That is a really tough way to go out for Will Hardy. And you got the new GM or new president of basketball operations in Austin Ainge. I think they want to make a big swing here, and I wouldn't be surprised if they try to move up. And you got San Antonio in a weird fit with Dylan Harper with next to De'Aaron Fox and Castle. I could see something brewing right there.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. I mean, look, I think Harper could be a hell of a player in the NBA. I want to make that very, very clear. I think if he develops the jumper, he could be an awesome, awesome player. And I think even without a jumper, he'll be a good player. I think he's going to get enough other qualities to be a good player in the NBA. He's the number two prospect on almost everybody's boards for a reason, because he's a high floor guy with a high ceiling. But time and time and time again, in my, this is my 12th, 13th year, whatever, doing drafts, so many times I've been burned by guys who I say, well, if he improves his jumper, and like so often guys don't. It's just the reality of it. More often than not, guys don't improve their jumpers. And I think for the Spurs and their situation in particular, I'd be a bit more weary of taking a guy where those are the questions when you just did it a year ago with Castle and you just traded it for a guy in Fox just 4 months ago with the same questions. So adding a third guy on top of that, I don't think I should be saying to myself, oh, I don't think the Spurs would have done the Fox trade if they knew they were getting Harper. Like, that's not it. That says something. And I understand the mindset of, you know, taking the guy and figuring it all out later. Well, trading for Fox says you're trying to accelerate now. You want to try to win now with Victor on his rookie contract right now where things are cheap. That's why they'd have interest in Giannis. That's why they'd have interest for Kevin Durant. I think they should at least consider a move down to three with Philly. Consider your idea with Utah. Consider some of these situations, because Knipl, Trey Johnson, VJ Edgecombe, a lot of these guys are great fits and high upside guys. And we'll see what the Spurs do, man. We are 11 days away from the NBA draft. I'm sure, especially once the finals wraps up, whenever that will be, Tom, we're going to get a hell of a lot more trade rumors. I look forward to doing some more pods with you. Whatever is happening, Tom, as we got game five on Monday, and then game six would be next Thursday. So I'll be doing my next pod on Monday. When would your next big number be? Because you and I would be going live Thursday night for that game six. When's your next big number?
Probably Wednesday. Yeah. So Wednesday. Okay. I think a Kevin Durant trade is done by then. I think it's done by then. Yeah.
I maybe this weekend or these two off days, or the two off days, Tuesday, Wednesday next week. One of these two windows, I think we're going to get a Kevin Durant deal as well. And who knows? Maybe we'll do an emergency podcast at some point when that happens. Tom, thanks for joining me tonight, man. I really appreciate it.
You got it, Kev. I think that was a loose ball foul by you. Scott Foster just called you a foul.
Oh, God. The extender.
Okay. Watch your hands podcast, watch your hands.
Big thank you to Tom Haverstraw for joining me tonight and to the whole team for producing us on this late Friday night. We'll be back again on Monday night with a post-game show, or maybe sooner if there's a Kevin Durant trade. We'll see about that. Could be an emergency podcast this weekend or on Monday morning ahead of Game 5 on Monday night. Enjoy your weekend, everybody.